the temperature goes up, potentially upwards of 1 billion people may have to move. That's in the scientific and technological literature. That's not me. For every 1 degree Celsius, potentially migration, and mainly from the subtropics and the central latitudes north. I'll give you an interesting story. So the German government, Germany, and I'm a big fan of Germany, I've worked with the government there for years, they had an organization that's part of the government do a study. And the organization did a study, and what they found in this study is that we need to begin to have orderly passage from countries that are in jeopardy to countries that may still have ecosystems that will be viable, right? And they said, first start in the Pacific, because those island nations are now going into the water. But then we have to move everywhere else. So they said, we need to think about climate passports. And I would say climate corridors. What do I mean by this? We had a situation like this after World War One. The great empires collapsed. The Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Persian Empire. So where there were empires, they had to remake them. So the U.S. government, I think, had a couple of guys in the State Department create new countries. But then people in these new countries, it wasn't their country. So they couldn't move and they couldn't stay. So they issued what they called the Nansen Report passport, named after the guy who created this idea of the passport. So you get a little passport and then you could go across political boundaries until you found a nation belonging to the League of Nations that would accept it. So this German government advisory commission said, we need the same thing. But even after it came about, even Germany said, well, wait, not so fast. And the UN, they said, maybe what you need to do, because they didn't want this. The UN said, why don't we just try to help countries around the world to be more resilient? We need to do that. But there's going to be countries not livable. Why do you think so many people are rushing across the Mediterranean from the Middle East where it's all desert? They don't have any water. They're dying in the Mediterranean on rickety boats trying to get to Europe and then move. Why is it there are so many people coming up from Mexico and Central America and South America, and they'll risk going 1,000 miles sometimes to get over the border and go north? People aren't talking about it. The media doesn't talk about it. Even the environmental groups don't talk about it. This is reality. We're going to have climate corridors and climate passports. What I mean by climate corridors is that we need to find ways that people can move from regions that they can't live in to new regions. And what we're doing, the scientific and technical community is already creating climate passports. You know how they're doing it? They're following our fellow creatures. From the insects to the mammals, they're all moving to try to stay in line with their biological clocks and the physiology with the climate they've known for millions of years. So you follow them on these climate corridors, and they're beginning to map them. But we have to stay somewhat removed so that we don't get too close and harm them. And then we have to have climate passports. Then the question is, how do we begin to see? We've always been nomadic. You know, we are a nomadic creature. When people said, oh, we're going to be nomads again, you asked that. We have people all over the world that are traveling every day all over the world. They maybe work in one part of the world, and then they come back part of the year to another part of the world. When I was a kid, you had one passport. Now, because of a global world, you can have many passports. People have dual passports with several countries because they're mobile and they're moving in various places in various continents. We used to have the issue you'd have to have visas traveling to a foreign country. Now, countries all over the world have gotten rid of visas, a few still haven't, so that you can have that kind of movement. Travel and tourism is the biggest industry in the world. It's movement. The average 19-year-old in our country lives in nine different places in different regions during their lifetime. So we've always been nomadic, but now we're going to be a little less sedentary and a little bit more nomadic. Then we need to build ephemeral cities, not refugee camps. And that is, with 3D printing, we can begin to assemble these camps very, very quickly and then disassemble and move them when we need to. The technology is there for the additive manufacturing. Those places should be ephemeral cities, not refugee camps, where they're governed by the people in those regions. So I know that we try to have these refugee camps to save people's lives, but they don't get control over them as a city where those who are there manage them. These are all things that are in the drawing board at this point with industries and with folks that are looking at climate change. but it's not in the popular conversation. Not yet, but it will be. And then there's all the universities that are putting together what we call incubator labs all over the world to try to look at all the new technologies go with living on a water planet. They're all over the world. So these are new things that we have to come to grips with. We can't just say, oh, this can't be done, or we don't think it's possible. We have no alternative because we're heading to an extinction event. But we have a great opportunity with a crisis that's collapsing what we live, how we live. So the question is, will we get there?
Well, at the time we speak, the global sea ice is at an all-time low. It was 81 degrees Fahrenheit, 27 C in New York City on Halloween Day. Global temperatures are always setting new records. Jeremy, if you have a mental climate map, where do you think we are?
I often get grandparents and parents asking, will my children be here and be able to live in this world, you know, and have a life? And now the young people are saying, I don't want to have children. They're all completely depressed about their future everywhere. What I say to the parents and grandparents is this. Our first industrial revolution, the 19th century in America, we did it all in 30 years. After the Civil War, the whole economy was in shambles. Families had killed each other across boundaries from north to south, relatives. The economy was just collapsed. What did we do? We laid out a railroad system, continental railroad system, across the entire North America. We did it right after the Civil War. That's number one. Number two, a new energy regime. We were able to distribute coal across the country. Communication revolution, the telephone. All right? The telegraph. Okay, we did all that in 30 years. Then we put together land-grant universities provided by the government. They gave free land for universities to allow them to create themselves, and then they could sell the land and actually build their universities. So we created these great land-grant universities that are now the centerpiece right now of our country, the Michigan University of the Michigan States, or the California system, or the Ohio State system. Then we laid out the dams, et cetera, that we needed for the water. We did all that. Second Industrial Revolution, we did in 25 years in the urban areas, starting in 1900. We put the telephone across the urban areas around 1900. Then we put in electricity lines across the urban areas, starting around that time. Then we put out millions of automobiles over the next 20 years. Then we put in pipe systems for the gas for the automobiles. We did all that in 25 years. The world took another 20. This is what we did. We're now in the third Industrial Revolution infrastructure, and we did a plan for Senator Schumer. I met with him for about 14 months. He was aware of the fact that we'd worked with the leadership of the EU and China for a long time. He said, how about a plan that's really for us? And so I spent personal time with him. We put together the engineers, the scientists, the policy people from around the world that we had done other plans, development plans. And we put together a huge plan, $17 trillion plan. Much of it didn't get in the plan, but some of it did. This is a matter of will. It's not a matter of the market. These technologies are all cheaper than the old technology they're replacing. The ideas are there. And we have actually done this kind of development in other regions. Let me share that for a moment. We've had successes and failures. And let me explain the difference. I'll give you one region that we worked in for 10 years. It's Hauts-de-France. It's the region from Lille to Dunkirk. It's the industrial region of France, the Rust Belt region of France, but still the major industrial area of France. It's the same home of Macron and Marie Le Pen. So when they came to me, the premier of that region said, would you do a plan for us? And I said, no, don't waste your time and don't waste your money. We've learned a lot from failures. Because if we do a plan for you, some minister will put it out as a pilot project and you'll think you've solved the problem. You can go to 12,000 mayors today and they'll show you all over the world. There's 5 electric buses. There are bicycle paths. I said, don't waste your time because we've seen failures, some that we were involved in. But he said, is there anything we can do? And I said, there is, but you're not going to like it. Go back to your region, the industrial region of France, and you line up every chamber of commerce, every mayor of every municipality, all 26 universities, all 260 high schools. You line up the entire society for 10 years of engagement to make the transition. You make it. We will help you. They don't come back. I'm telling you, I can't tell you how many times they never come back. This guy actually came back. Months later, we got it. We're ready. We spent 10 years with them. They did it. And they're the poster child of Europe. And there are films. I'll send you a little documentary showing what they did. New tech parks. New way, putting in solar and wind across the region. Transforming the universities so they were clinical universities and team teaching. They did all of it. This could be done anywhere. They even taught grandchildren of coal miners to retrofit buildings and put up solar and wind.
To do these things, for example, in America, we would have to have the public support. The leaders say, well, we can't go too far, and this happens in all countries, so we can't go too far ahead of our population. And there's been a long-time myth, I think, in the environmental movement that the next big climate disaster will cause some sort of social tipping point, an awakening, and masses of people will finally demand action. But that hasn't happened. We've seen disaster after disaster. So if we let go that myth of learning by disaster, what do we have left?
What you just said is very profound. And it, you hit really seriously the problem. Everyone thinks there'll be this critical turning point, and then we will deal with this. It hasn't happened. It's like the frog in the pot heating up, and they'll boil themselves to death. They don't jump. What's happening now is something different. And that is we are moving from geopolitics, even though we all think it's all geopolitics now, it's the last gasp of the industrial age. We are moving out of that. It's dying. But everybody in every nation state is trying to hold on in a geopolitical world. That's what's going on with all these elections. They don't know them. That's what it's all about. It's the fear because it's a paradigm dying after two centuries of the economic system we've had and the industrial age, et cetera. And so what's happened is that in that wake, we're beginning to realize, as I said before, that these climate events don't honor political boundaries. They affect ecosystems. And when you affect an ecosystem, you have to cross those political boundaries, whether it's a national boundary, a state boundary, or municipal boundary, and work together. Because you have to deal with preparation, rescue, restoration, and reclamation. So what's happening at the local level is bioregional governances are coming in. They don't mean the end of nation states, but it's an extension into bioregions. And this is going to be crucial. And it takes us into a world that Eleanor Ostrom talked about with commons. You have to share your commons as a life source, not a resource, and not exploit it and manipulate it and commodify it and use it up. When you begin working with each other and neighbors to do this, and it becomes more formalized with citizen science juries, you remember the Porto Alegre thing where you said, let's have, you know, a situation where we can have the public decide the what governments expend their money on, remember? And it went all over the world. Everyone's doing this. Well, you have to do this with citizen science juries. That means you have to start when the kids are in grade school. They can't learn about nature on a two-minute Zoom or a two-minute video. They have to be out there in clinical learning. In the environment. There's no other way to do it. If we lock ourselves away in a virtual habitat, we'll become increasingly frightened of the outside world. Right now, the average American spends 92% of the time indoors and 7 hours a day on a cell phone in virtual worlds. That's not good. And we're not alone. This is happening all over the world. So our young people are frightened of nature, don't think about nature, but there's a significant amount of them that are moving in a new direction. This is where the hope comes in. Maybe we could talk about that and you know, where do we think there are possibilities to make this change so we don't have to be in this rut we're in?
By all means, please tell us some of the alternatives and possibilities that we've got because we need them.
Well, there's a couple of interesting things. First is this. I didn't come up with any of these ideas. What happened is they sort of came up and then people started to get into them in various countries around the world and companies and whatever. But each step, we didn't see the next step. And what we began to see is these infrastructure revolutions, like this third industrial revolution infrastructure, it created its own futures by whatever that existed, allowed them, the new technology they create, to actually take it to the next stage and with the other parts of the infrastructure. So first, the communication internet. And when I wrote the book End of Work in 1995, we just had the communication internet. Then in 2000, I wrote the Hydrogen Economy book, because at that point, we were beginning to take a look at an energy internet with solar and wind, just starting. And then a little bit later, the technology wrote us again with the mobility internet. Then the technology again, more recently, came up with the water internets and edge data centers. So that when you get all the generation starting to think of these new technologies, they have a way of creating a situation that you didn't expect at the get-go. So this is a little chart from our experience, and see if this resonates with you, all right? We have a real shift going on with the younger generation. They may not articulate it, but they're shifting from capitalism to hydroism. It's just beginning. Capital, the business community thinks capital is your intellectual property, the machines you have, your inventory, et cetera. That's secondary. In nature, the only capital that we rely on is photosynthesis and net primary production. Without that, you don't have species, you don't have capital, derivatory capital. That's it. So the real capital is the water planet. Without water, the hydrosphere, you don't have the elements for life. The waters of the hydrosphere, they weather the rocks and the mountains, like Grand Canyon. They weather those rocks. Then when the rocks become elements, they become the sediment of the soil. Then the elements go to the plants, then into the animals, then into our bodies. Then the molecules, the atoms go somewhere else. The phosphorus in my tooth came from a mountain, okay? So we take the water from the planet, the molecules come in, the 60% of our body, then they go somewhere else. We take in the oxygen from the atmosphere, and that relies on the waters, because the oceans create the phytoplankton that then becomes the oxygen and the biosphere. So all of these things are a process that's moving at every moment. Then we're realizing something. This is very hopeful for young people. I'm sitting here and I'm looking out my window at the high-tech corridor of Bethesda Barrel. And there's the Naval Hospital. Next to that is the NIH, the greatest scientific body in the world, the National Institutes of Health. They have a project there that will change the thinking of every single person that listens to your podcast and every kid that grows up in the future. They've created a project called the Human Microbiome Project. Biome is the ecosystem that create a big presence across continents. What they're saying is a mind blow. They're saying that every human being on this planet and every other species is actually an ecosystem. We're not talking about something that's just a thought. It's literal. For example, as I said, we take water molecules in our body. They go somewhere else. The elements from the mountains in the sediment, they go in our bodies. They go somewhere else. The skeleton, human skeleton, is replaced every 10 years. Totally new skeleton from the elements that came from the mountains. Beside that, we realize now that humans are not alone in their own body. We just discovered there are millions of other creatures in our bodies. There's the proteus, the archaea, the fungi, the bacteria, the viruses. Only 44% of the cells in our body are human. The other 56% belong to these other creatures. We only have 20,000 human genes. Watson and Crick probably wouldn't have understood this. There are millions of other genes in our body, the other creatures. So the NIH projects now moved to the European Union and now to China, and they're in Japan, and they're working on it. Think of what it would be if a little kid learns when they're, let's say, in third grade or fourth grade, that every human being is an ecosystem. We're all unique, but we're part of we are an ecosystem within an ecosystem. Would that change the way they feel about nature fundamentally? Would they then think they're part of some bigger experiment called an animated planet? And instead of being afraid, they would say, well, I'm part of this planet. I have a responsibility to steward my relationship to it. And what happens if young people grow up with that thought? It changes everything. What happens if they grow up and then they ask mommy and daddy when they're 5 years old, what is this place we live in? Looking around. And mommy and daddy said, it's a water planet, sweetie. You live on planet Aqua. Wouldn't that change the entire way the young person grows up and thinks about the world around them? There's two other things that give me hope. And that is the Smithsonian Institution, which are the great museums in Washington, did a study along with NYU researchers at New York University. They asked how did humans survive? We're a pretty thin, little, weak creature. How did we survive over millennia? And the old story was kind of not much of a story. The last ice age receded. We came out of the Rift Valley of Africa and we ran around the world. Then they went through the geological record and it shocked them. What they found in the geological record is hominids emerged 800,000 years, our ancestors. Then Neanderthals, 350,000 years. Homo sapiens, 250,000 years. And during that period was the most violent, extreme changes in climate that you'll see in much of our planet's history. How did they survive this? So what happened was the planet tilts occasionally over millions of years, sometimes closer to the sun, sometimes further away. No way of knowing about when. It tilted. And when that tilt happened 800,000 years ago and the hominids emerged, they began to see a cycle in the geological record of 100,000 years of ice age, 10,000 years of global warming. 100,000 years ice age, 10,000 global warming for eight cycles. Now, it's not going to happen again because we're now in climate change, which changes the water cycles fundamentally. And they said, how do they survive this, humans? Big brain, the biggest brain, neocortex, and we have language. Other creatures can share knowledge to their offspring, but we can do it in a much more profound way. In other words, we have that ability. Number two, this, the opposable thumb and fingers. We are the best tool makers. We've got the thumbs and fingers. Number three, we're a cooperative species. What we've learned from our scientists in the 1990s is we have mirror neurons. We always knew we were empathic. We have actual neurons set up here that allow us to actually experience another living creature, a human or another creature, as if we were experiencing our own bodies. We know it's not us, but we feel it. Whether it's their fear, their grief, their happiness, this allows us to cooperate. So there are periods in history where we cooperate in these great social infrastructures, empathy expands, and then when those urban civilizations collapse, we start killing each other off. And so the elements are there for this transition, and the market's there, and the technology is emerging, but the story isn't there. That's what I'm trying to say today. We need this new story of living on a water planet.
As we wrap up here, what are you working on these days?
Well, I'm putting much of my attention. I'm doing one last book in this last series. The first one was The Age of Resilience. The second was Planet Aqua. I'm doing the last one on how we began to rethink intelligence and what intelligence is all about. How do we begin to rethink intelligence when we realize that there's no such thing as an object or a structure or a passive resource? That everything on this planet is in constant movement at every moment, whether it's the mountains or the hydrosphere, which is the key to all of this, or the atmosphere. And these are processes and patterns and flows in an animated planet. Every moment is changing, like the butterfly effect. The butterfly flaps its wings. That may create a tornado 5 weeks later somewhere. Everything's infected. So when you begin to think of the planet as a living animated Earth planet, it is. It really is. It's processes and patterns that are always interacting at every moment and creating all sorts of externalities that affect everything else. And the awe of this is inspiring once we realize this, because that awe that we're part of something much bigger, that's unique, a living planet, not a metaphor. We begin to have imagination, a sense of wonder and imagination, and a sense of transcendence. It's a big deal. People know in their gut that they want to be alive. So does every other species. But then the question is, how do we make this relevant to the rest of future generations here? The last thought, the Gen Zs. So I watched the protests. Okay, I don't watch the protests. The Friday for Futures, I'm sure you probably did something on it. You had millions of young people leaving their schools on Friday in 141 countries. They did it like 5-6 times, calling for a climate emergency. And I thought that's good for them. That's good. These protests are important. But then I really didn't understand it until I met with three Gen Zs in Milan. And then it hit me. This is the first time an entire generation of human beings on this planet went out on the streets together and they saw themselves as an endangered species. They didn't articulate it, but they saw themselves as an endangered species and they saw their fellow creatures as part of their evolutionary family. That's never happened in history. So all the things that have divided us, our loyalties to our nation, our religious ties, our blood ties, all of those things are still here. But This has never happened before, that an entire generation saw themselves as a species in danger, their fellow creatures, part of the family. That is so empowering. And I wish that they would hear what I'm saying to them, because they didn't think of that. They just did it. Once you think of it, you can't get rid of that idea. And what happens if they think of that and they're in high schools and universities and they begin to realize, yeah, we're an endangered species, our fellow creatures. We know that, so we have to act as if we are able to steward this planet and learn to live on an animated life planet. So my frustration is, I'm guardedly hopeful. I'm not naive. I don't know if we'll make it. But what I tried to do in this planet, Aqua, is say, rethink it. And you know, one last thing on this. I would never imagine 50 years ago that there would be a time when governing regions and even nation states would give rights to the waters. They're doing, as you know. So they're actually giving rights to waters. And we gave rights to corporations as human rights, you know, the 14th Amendment. So did the UK with their constitution, Canada. So, you know, corporations have rights like humans. But now, if you go to Australia, New Zealand, Quebec, all sorts of places, South America, they're giving rights to waters to be free to go where they need to go. They're going to go anywhere. And they have guardians that go to court on their behalf. Would you imagine that could happen? What happens if we rebrand this planet, Planet Aqua? What I would say in some last pages of the book, we should have a second name. Keep Planet Earth for a while if you want. But in your constitutions and the codes and the legal matters, have a second name, Planet Aqua. And those kids go to school and they realize they live in Planet Aqua, it'll change your entire life. If they realize that they are an ecosystem like every other ecosystem, and they're part of a great experiment called life on the planet, it will change. If they think they're the most adaptive species and they can handle a lot of different climate events over history, and they can make it and maybe flourish in new ways, they'll be able to thrive, hopefully, and flourish. So that's the story. But as long as our journalists, and they're the ones that have to tell the story, only want to ask questions about the current event and what's the new ESG principles and that stuff, everyone knows this is not enough. Not when you have the possibility of rethinking the human journey on this wonderful living planet, universe. Our space administration, they're going out across the whole universe. What are they looking for? Water. So that should be a clue. So now a last thought. There's a little parable in the book. Two little fish are swimming in the ocean. Young fish, having a nice time. This real old fish with white whiskers comes by the other way and stops with them and says, "Hello, boys. How's the water today?" The two little fish, they just keep going. Then a couple of minutes later, one little fish says to the other little fish, "What the hell is water?" "It's the medium, so we don't think about it. It's everything. It's what makes life possible. But it's so close to us, we don't think about it." So that parable made sense to me. My hope is that with podcasts like this, a new generation will roll up their sleeves and do some homework and start thinking about this water planet ontologically, philosophically, in terms of economic system, in terms of the new technologies we have to develop, how we do pedagogy and curriculum, how we create clinical learning environments. All these things is a treasure trove to engage future generations in an exciting experiment to bring back this water planet by seeing it as a life source, not a resource, and by understanding how precious this little experiment universe is.
We have been speaking with visionary activist and best-selling author Jeremy Rifkin. He founded and operates from the Foundation on Economic Trends. You can dig deeper with links in my blog at ecoshock.org and find Jeremy directly at foet.org. Look for his new book, Planet Aqua, Rethinking Our Home in the Universe. Jeremy, thank you for spending your valuable time with our listeners.
And thank you for giving me the time. I really appreciate it.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Changing fast, how long will it last? The change is here.
My name's Eric.